I'll bring the Mining and Outdoor Recreation Committee to order. Representative Keel moves the minutes. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. Folks, members and audience, we've got a lot of bills to get through today. So I hope that we can keep testimony short. We've got a lot to get through, so we'll be moving very quickly. Representative Russo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to introduce another student I have shadowing me today. She is Emily Schmiedeberg, who is down here with a group from the FCCLA, and Emily goes to Lancaster Public Schools. Emily, if you
please stand. Thank you for visiting us today.
And
Representative Russo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Emily has the double pleasure of getting to see her dad testify later in committee.
Cool.
Thank you.
Okay, folks, we're going to start right off with Representative Anderson's bill. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I'd like to,
move the bill.
Move the bill and then the delete all amendment.
Representative Anderson moves House File 3207 to bring the bill before us. I think we're going to move it to the General Register.
Yes, sir.
And we'd like to get the bill in the shape that you'd like, so you will. Representative Anderson also moves the DE1 amendment to get it in the shape he likes. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted in the shape that you like. Please present your bill.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I've been approached by several lake associations, including my own, and so these are constituents of mine, that they have serious concerns with the DNR's lake management policies, including the stocking of muskies. So and just to make this short, we just decided to prevent the DNR from stocking muskies initially into doing any new stocking, but then we just thought we'd restrict it down to this new set of six lakes. So that being said, there's a lot of history with the management and even mismanagement of the fisheries within Minnesota through the DNR, and this is what's brought the concern with a lot of my constituents and lake associations around the state of Minnesota. That's the nature of the bill. I'd like to introduce you to my testifier today. It's Mr. Joe Frowney, who used to be with the Minnesota DNR from the Brainerd area. Mr. Frowney.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. And I want folks to know that we've got a lot to do. I've got about 15 minutes slotted for this bill, so hopefully we can get through all the testimony in that amount of time, Representative Anderson. When folks come up to testify, we're going to limit their testimony to 2 minutes. So please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Thank you, Mark, and I appreciate being here, the invitation, and I appreciate all the service you people do to the state of Minnesota. I have a 38-year career with retiring in 99 with the Department of Natural Resources as the area supervisor in Brainerd for 30 years for the section of fisheries. And during that time, we wrote up a lot of management plans. That was kind of my forte, along with a lot of other things. And one of the big things we had in our management plans was local and social considerations. And through the years, we've had a lot of opposition to any type of muskie stocking. I guess I never really catered to special interest groups that were trying to force this stuff through us, and I don't want to see a situation like we've got in Mille Lacs Lake, although they're somewhat different. Gull Lake has now got a great walleye fishery. You know, you're not going to teach kids to fishing muskies. If you take your grandkid or kids out and they don't catch a sunfish within about 20 minutes, you're headed for shore. So there's no training or no issues there that I can see. The other thing I see that muskies require a fairly large forage base. Global warming has seen an increase in the number of summer kills on the tulipy population in that lake, along with everybody else. And the other thing is it would probably create another tournament, which we certainly don't need in that area. I mean, it seems like every weekend, if you want to take your kid fishing, every access is locked up with $30,000 boats and $30,000 Suburbans, and so I guess it just creates a really unnatural situation. And the other thing, muskies are a top predator, and I'm just concerned about the walleye situation and the overall health of the lake. I've seen a great increase in the water quality in that lake. I think a lot of it can be attributed to the loss of a lot of cow-calf operations in the headwaters, where we have three major streams that enter the lake, and a lot of those people are no longer in business, and it I think it has had a great effect on the lake. But overall, I feel that muskies are just a bad choice, and I would sooner err in our favor of conservation than some destructive thing that could happen.
Thank you very much for your testimony, sir. We are limiting our testimony to 2 minutes apiece, so thank you very much. I give you a little extra time because you're Representative Anderson's main testifier. With that, I would Representative Considine, any question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm still not clear as to what the detriment is of putting muskies in the lake. What's the problem with doing so? That's not clear to me.
Mr. Prani, maybe you'd like to comment?
Would you repeat the question, sir?
Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not clear as to what the problem is. What is the objection to stocking muskies in these lakes?
Well, I guess I'm not clear what the problem is either, but it could be a problem. I think, again, they're a top predator. We're losing the forage base due to global warming, and, of course, walleyes would be a favored species of those fish. And you see the size of some of those muskies in Gull Lake. Well, they're not eating alfalfa.
Representative Costain.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If you're not sure what the detriment is to having the muskies in there, why are we...
Well, I'm saying that if we're to err, we should err in the side of conservation and not put something in there that a few years later we're going to regret. And there you're sitting with it.
Representative Mehta.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to that point, in your history working with the DNR, I'm sure you know that walleye were stocked in many lakes where they didn't exist.
Absolutely.
And it seems to me that this legislation is here to protect the walleye fishing, and it sounds like in your testimony, giving kids a good chance. As a 14-year-old who grew up on a cabin in northern Minnesota, spending a lot of my summertime there, I just think that this bill's a little rushed, and to come out and say that we shouldn't have allow the DNR to stock in these specific lakes doesn't really make sense to me.
Well, we're not banning all lakes, just those five lakes.
And so for me...
And I think here's the point, too. Do we really want to increase fishing pressure for another species in that system? It's unbelievable now what's going on that lake with contest fishing, guide pressure. It's a different ball game there than it is in a lot of lakes in this state.
And which specific lake are you talking
about? Well, Gull Lake, Round Lake, the whole system there. Nisswa, the whole business is just every weekend it seems like there's some kind of a contest. And a lot of these contests are for fish sponsor people to probably catch fishermen, not to catch fish, with their products. And the access thing. And the other thing is, I think if we were to if there was a study made where situations where there weren't tournaments and accesses, we probably wouldn't have much of a problem with invasive species.
Representative Mehta?
Well, I'm just kind of curious. So you're saying that you don't want money spent by people who fish for muskie done in that part of the state?
No, I'm not saying that at all. I'm saying enough is enough. And I think muskies could be a detriment.
Well, and on that same line, we've had bass fishing, which was very popular, still is, as sports
fishing. We don't have a problem with bass numbers.
And do we have a definitive problem that you can prove with scientific evidence that is saying that muskie are doing different? I don't think you do. And the point
I'm trying to make, sir,
is that what we're doing here is basically saying the fastest growing sports fishing in the state, where we are renowned for not only having good fishing for these types of fish, our tackle makers, Northland Tackle and Bemidji, many down here in the metro area, many small mom and pop shops around the state are selling their gear now nationwide. And so essentially what we're doing is putting up a roadblock and saying, you know, this area of the state's closed for business for this. And I think it's an inappropriate thing to come to legislature for, just like it was inappropriate for the cabin owners from my district before, who came to bring the muskie size limit to an increase. And so I just don't see any legislative rationale for us getting involved in this decision. I think we should let the DNR do their work here. And if we find problems, we can always stop the stalking, and they should kind of take care of themselves.
When Representative Anderson?
Mr. Chair, I can help explain a little bit of this too. Having been on the lake and listened to the lake associations, as well as the property owners, as well as what the DNRs had to say, the problem that we've had is that these lakes have been mismanaged. I hear from our local fishing guides on Gull that the walleye population is very, very low. These are guides that are telling us this. And walleye, as far as the best of my knowledge, is still our state fish. And you go to a lot of lakes, they're having trouble. It's we were following what's going on Mille Lacs right now. Mille Lacs is mismanaged. Where do you want to start with that, and where do you want to end with that? That's irrelevant. It's mismanaged. The walleye population is mismanaged in many lakes. And on these lakes, you want to introduce, or the DNR wants to introduce another fish. Why? They have mismanaged the current fishing. And the locals that are around there understand that. They see it. They hear it. They fish it. They hear it from the guides. They hear it from everybody. We're the locals. And when people go out and they buy, and they are going to go fishing for walleye or anything else, they're still buying tackle. The tackle's still there.
Representative Mesa, and members, we've got 14 other folks that want to testify, and we've got 10 bills to get through. Representative Mesa.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm still kind of perplexed. It's mismanaged. My understanding is a gentleman who invented the weed roller, which is essentially destroying the habitat for fishing on some of these lakes, is one of the main advocates against stocking musk lunge in these remaining lakes here. And so the other thing I'm confused about is, if there's this widespread support, why in the hundreds of emails I got was it like 1 to 200 in favor of your legislation? I mean, it's just overwhelmingly been nothing in my inbox, at least for contacts on my phone, on my social media, saying this is a bad idea. Let the DNR do their job and stock these lakes.
Well, I can tell you this much, that the Gull Lake Property Owners Association did a survey not only on their lake, but I think we had about 1,200 replies back. 70% of the residents and locals were opposed to any type of muskie stocking, pure and simple.
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair, I was just going to highlight that point, that the locals have weighed in. And the DNR is supposed to be taking that into consideration just based on their own policy and writing these lake management plans. And it seems like right now what's going on with not only Gull, but a couple of these other lakes that are listed on our list, these lake associations and the lakes themselves are being, they're being steamrolled by the DNR. You are going to put these in whether you like it or not.
That's not a real good policy. We're finding out what's going on in Mille Lacs, and it's not looking pretty.
And
Mr. Chair, just as a follow-up on all of these emails that are circulating, I think there's, been maybe 10 different emails sent, just basically cut and paste by a lot of organizations. Most of them I seem to be getting are coming from out of state. I'm getting them from Canada. I'm getting them from Pennsylvania. But as far as my constituents, who I am addressing, and that's why I brought this bill forward, is for my constituents, not the constituents down in any other state. This is for my constituents. That's why they elected me. That's why I'm here. That's why they want me to bring this bill. They brought it to me. I'm bringing it to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So could you let me know, are these waters owned privately by these individuals?
None of the waters are, Mr. Chairman, are owned by the people that live on the lakes. But they also put docks out, and if you really wanted to qualify that, you could almost have everybody pull a dock out of a lake, too, because that actually is on public water. You can't put a sign, even a political sign, so far to a ditch. Same thing proclaim to a dock out there. Nobody owns the lake. We get that. But the people that do live on the lake are good stewards of the lake. They hear things. They see what comes on. They see what goes off. They are now bound by the restrictions. Gull Lake itself is basically turned into a military zone. At some of the lake accesses, you'll see two DNR people and one uniformed cop with a squad car there on a Sunday afternoon. And it's a recreational lake. Where are we going with the muskies? We can't even keep up with the walleye. And now you want to bring in the biggest predator fish that's out there. And based on the performance of the DNR with a lot of these other things, they brought in this other predator called a wolf. I don't want to go into that right now, but what's this attraction with bringing in all these predator fish and not maintaining our base?
Representative Constantine.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Metzl. Folks, we've got other business to take care of. And we're going to move on this bill in about 5 minutes, because I had 15 minutes allotted for the bill, and we've got other bills to get to. So a lot of testimony from the public will not be able to take place. We're kind of beating a dead horse here. So Representative Metzl.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess if we're moving this quickly on it, I think it's a miscalculation for it to go to the general register, and I'd like to motion for it to be tabled for now.
All in favor of that motion, signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed?
No.
No. Motion does not prevail. Okay, Representative Constantine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The testifier has testified that he doesn't know what the problem is with stocking, that it might cause a problem in a few years. Do we have somebody from the DNR that can address this?
Well, we're trying to get to that testimony.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Then I'll stop so I can hear that.
Representative Rizzo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The DNR's charge is to manage the lakes as a resource for all the people of Minnesota. And the testifier, in the course of your remarks, mentioned that part of the problem was access to the lake. And I wondered if you could clarify what he meant by that.
Thank you. I can clarify that by saying the access is because of a lot of the fishing activity, primarily contests, are unusable by the general public because they're all tied up.
Representative Houston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the problem is that people can't get to the lake because so many people are getting to the lake.
Well, I think, fishing is a recreational opportunity for all of the people in the state of Minnesota, not a select few special interest groups that want to perpetuate the muskie program.
Representative Erison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We also heard, now I don't know what was meant by the term military zone, when there's law enforcement apparently doing their job, doing crowd control where there are crowds. Seems like we're attracting a lot of people to the sport of fishing. And one of the earlier comments was about whether young kids can learn to fish now. I never fished for muskie myself, but I didn't learn on any sunnies either. We learned trolling for northerns. I would echo the comments about the lake is a resource for everybody. It's not owned by the people that own the property around the lake. Access is one of those things that's to all of the lakes is a cherished Minnesota tradition and part of a major responsibility of the DNR. So I'd be much more interested in hearing about what the actual population dynamics are in these lakes and what some actual evidence. We heard an awful lot of testimony about Mille Lacs before, and we didn't hear anybody blaming it on the muskie at the time.
Well, I disagree with you on that, Representative Urizel, because I'm the one that brought it up.
Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Okay. I remember a lot of focus, though, on an awful lot of additional issues, including the northern pike in that lake. Thank you.
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, just a comment. It's got in a little deeper than we wanted right now. But I got to bring this up to answer some of the questions across the table here. I have a 212-acre lake in my district. When I grew up, we could go out there an hour and a half, catch our limit of 10 to 12-inch crappies. In the late 1990s, DNR started stocking that lake with walleye. They were not natives of that lake. And at this time, the walleye aren't that great out there, but you can still catch a few crappies, but they're 6 to 7 inches. The walleye, by stocking that lake with native fish, or fish that are not natives of that lake, they've literally destroyed that fishery. We used to have 300 to 500 fish houses on that lake every winter. Now we're lucky to see 15 to 20. I don't think the science is there yet. We need to find out more what's going on with the lakes we have stocked. What's it going to do to the biology and the rest of the fish species in there?
We're going to bring up DNR Fisheries Chief Don Pereira at this time. Thank you for your testimony, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're going to have to move.
What?
You didn't take your spot.
Oh. Okay.
Welcome to the committee, and please state your name and who you represent for the record.
For the record, I'm Don Pereira, Chief of Fisheries for the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony regarding this bill today. I will speak to some of the central components of our muskie launch management program, and specifically how we are justified in making a very, very modest expansion in muskie fishing opportunities throughout the state. Starting with our long-range plan, we had a very open public input process that started in 2007 and completed in 2008 that laid out a long-range plan for large northern pike and muskie launch. As part of that plan, we identified a justifiable need to make a modest increase and the number of muskie launch waters throughout the state. There's ample lines of evidence that indicate that the sport of muskie launch angling has been increasing. It's a sport fishery in Minnesota that's outstanding. We attract residents, anglers from other states that make Minnesota a destination state for muskie launch fishing. If you talk to Explore Minnesota Tourism, they will say that's a great thing if we can bring in non-residents and bring in tourist dollars into the state. So economically, it's a win for all of us. In that document, we lay out a very specific process by which we go through a number of criteria to identify the best candidate lakes where we can introduce muskie launch. And we've used that process to identify the 6 lakes that are before us now that basically are probably 6 of the best candidate lakes throughout the state. Back in that plan, we agreed that we would create only 8 new muskie launch fisheries, and that's it. So we essentially drew a line in the sand with the muskie anglers themselves. 8 new fisheries. We've created 3. We want to create 5 more. We have about 99 bodies of water that we actively manage muskie launch that provide reasonable muskie launch fishing in the state. We simply want to add an additional 5 to those. We manage muskellunge at very low densities, which is why our muskellunge fishing is so good. A lot of people want to cite studies in Wisconsin that's comparing apples and oranges. We manage all of our muskellunge fisheries for a density of one adult per 4 to 10 surface acres. That's a very low density of fish. We've heard Mille Lacs brought up as a problem for muskellunge. It is not a problem. Muskellunge have a density of Mille Lacs of about one adult per 50 acres, which is also why it produces a small number of wonderful trophy-sized fish as it did this past fall. So our muskellunge program is, first of all, I think it's justified based on what we've heard from our users. It's ecologically benign, and it's safe in many other ways. In regards to crowding, I'm not sure how popular muskellunge tournaments are, but we put in, with a lot of mashing of teeth with tournament anglers, we put in rules for determining how tournaments will occur in our lakes to prevent crowding at our accesses. And also the other aspect of muskellunge fishing is that the peak of muskellunge fishing happens in late summer and in the fall when our lakes are less busy. So we think that there will be a very modest, probably not even noticeable increase in boat traffic in some of these waters, but it will expand what is now a great fishery, but is becoming a bit of a crowded fishery by muskellunge anglers that use that resource. And so I also want to state that we were very fair and open and honest in our public input. We opened up our website. We received over 1,500 comments on our website. We cataloged those for each of those six proposed waters. They were available for anybody to comment on. It wasn't a targeted survey for specific property owners. It was for all angles of the state. And those comments are now processed, and they're available for anybody to view if they want to. And it will show you that we have pretty broad-scale support across the public for improving our offering this modest increase in musky fisheries throughout the state. And finally, I want to close, because I know you're short on time, in that we did hear from some local units of government that did not have enough time to comment, so we are going to wait and take more time to have additional public meetings with some of those local units of government that want to have further discussions with us. So with that, I will end my testimony, and I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Well, I do have a question for you, Mr. Faria. You said that the local units of government did not have enough time to comment, and you're going to wait for them to comment. What does that mean? How long are you going to wait? I mean, are we going to wait until the next legislative session, or are you going to do it after we adjourn and before we come back?
We're in the process of contacting those local units of government now, and we would like to try to make the decision. This process has been going on for quite a while now. We had our area managers have been talking to the local stakeholders about this, and then we actually had focused open meetings at each of the locations. We had one meeting in Otter Tail County for the three proposals out there. We'll choose one of those three out in Otter Tail, by the way. And then we had public meetings for Big Marine, Dull Lake, and Fairmount Chain. And then we had one general meeting for all six of the lakes together in North Metro back in November. So the process has been thorough. It's been ongoing, and we hope to try to wrap up these call for discussions with some more LGUs this summer and try to make a decision by sometime this summer.
Well, Chief Pereira, the reason this bill is here is because you did hold some town hall meetings in all of these different locations, and there was an outpouring of folks that came to those meetings, and they spoke up against this. And then when you came together at the Bunker Hills Activity Center, all those folks were there as well. And it was commented there that at all these different locations, everybody was against this happening. The people spoke out at each one of these different town hall meetings. But just like the other day, and we heard some comments in Representative McNamara's committee about the DNR not listening to people. And they're not listening to the people that are involved in these things. And they spoke out against this happening to their lakes in their area. I know we heard some comments about the lakes are owned by all the people in the state, and that's true, but the people around the lake and live on the lake, they take care of those lakes, and they care about them. Mm-hmm. They're doing very, very good things for those lakes, and they're not being listened to. Well, that's the issue, Chief Pereira. They're not being heard, and I heard at the Bunker Hills Activity Center that you hold these meetings and then don't pay any attention to what's going on. You don't listen to the people. So that's why this bill is here. Let's at least stop this from happening until we can get a better handle on this thing And if we can come back next year and maybe make some changes and do a little bit better of, maybe we can find some different lakes where people are more accepting of this, maybe we can do that. But that's why this bill is here, is because what I heard at Bunker Hills Activity Center is that the DNR is not listening to the people.
Mr. Chairman, I respect your opinion with that. What we do, we have had a number of different ways that we've taken public input. Again, we've opened up our website for all the public to provide comments. Those comments are now available for the public to look at if they would like to look at those. What we often see when we hold open public meetings is that quite often if the meeting is not strongly attended, there's generally positive to neutral support. Quite often those public meetings are attended by and they're more attended by those that are more vocally opposed to some of our manager processes, and that's why we've invested in other methods for also getting public input, such as using our website and also doing focus surveys as well, which we've done, for example, with the Northern Pike regulations.
Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Same question as the last testifier. What are the problems associated with stocking muskies in lakes?
Chief Pratt.
We've identified no problems. So we've introduced muskellunge in about 44 lakes throughout the state, historically going back quite a while. We were able to do detailed evaluation on those lakes, on about 36 of those lakes, including a number of lake surveys prior to introduction, and then following the changes in the fish community after introduction, there were no changes in the fish community. Our critics hired some ecologists at one of our state universities to look at that study. They criticized it. When we addressed their criticism, we did more detailed rigor to address their criticism and actually strengthen the study. I'm very, very confident in telling you that the way we manage muskellunge in Minnesota at such low density, this is a pure trophy animal. It's a small number of individuals per lake. They are ecologically benign. If you look at the amount of ciscos that are currently being eaten by tulipy, by northern pike and walleye and Gull Lake, it's far, far more than any muskellunge will eat if we introduce muskellunge into Gull Lake. I do think that some of the concerns are really unfounded. I honestly feel that way.
Okay, we're going to move on to additional testimony. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Tim Spreck. I have to announce, too, that we're going to have to move on, and I apologize to people that came to testify on this bill, but we have many, many, many other bills to get through. We put this at the beginning of the agenda. I didn't know it was going to take so much time, so I apologize. So we're going to hear from Mr. Tim Speck, and then we're going to hear another one against the bill. So then we'll call it quits and vote on the bill. Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Mr. Chair and Committee, I'm Tim Speck. I'm speaking today on behalf of the Minnesota Dark Horse Angling Association. It's a shame that we won't be able to have additional testimony today. We've got people who traveled 3-4 hours. They did present some information in your packets. I would suggest that you all look at the list of opposing, would be the list of local units of government, lake associations, individuals, et cetera, et cetera, on the first page that support this bill. It's critically important to understand that a lot of the people that I represent live out in the woods. They're on the ice. They're out in the outdoors. They don't have access to computers. They don't know how to run them. They would have no idea how to respond to a DNR survey. That's why they pay a guy like me to be down here. I'm representing literally thousands and thousands of spear fishermen, and unanimously we support this bill. The other thing that I would like you all to understand while you're looking at the opposition list is that these people also represent literally thousands and thousands and thousands of stakeholders around the state who are also in support of this bill. The one thing I want to leave you with today as I get ready to move on is that there are ample opportunities currently to fish muskie. Currently, 40% of our waters are actively managed and stocked. That represents 790,000 acres. And there's plenty of opportunity. In fact, there's plenty of opportunity for muskie fishermen who are supposed to be chasing the fish of 10,000 casts. Well, frankly, you can catch muskie just about anywhere right now. And with the latest movement by the legislature to limit the 54-inch minimum on muskie stocking, we've got an entirely new dynamic in play here where it's a de facto catch and release on muskie. We don't have any idea how this is going to affect the fishery, how it's going to affect the forage, how it's going to affect the base, because these fish literally will grow and grow and grow until one day they die of old age. So please keep that in mind. The dynamics have changed. There's ample opportunity currently. There's no reason to jeopardize our waters in any way at this time by introducing additional muskie lakes, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. I'm going to have Vern Wagner. Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Nessa.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just correct for the record, I did talk to many spear fishermen and women in my district, and they are fine with expanding the stocking. So I think it is a little disingenuous to say that thousands and thousands and thousands of people, when I didn't get a call from a single one, in fact, I went the extra mile to reach out to the people in my district who do enjoy the great outdoors and these type of activities, are all opposed to this.
Thank you. Vern, you want to come down? Vern Wagner and Sean Collette, you want to come down together? And
Senator, would it be okay for me to defer to my associate?
Sure. Come on down. We're short of time, so between the two of you, we'll give you a minute each, and we'll get rolling here. Thank you very much for coming in. Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Greetings, Chairman Hackbark. My name is Travis Frank. I work as a Minnesota fishing guide, and
please repeat your name.
Travis Frank.
Thank you.
I am a Minnesota fishing guide, and I work for Ron Scherer Productions as a television producer. My livelihood and my passion revolve around fishing. For 15 years, I've been a fishing guide in Minnesota, and I have taken out customers from all over the country. They come here because my number one request is they want to catch muskies. We have built the greatest fishery in the country that other states are trying to mimic. But the most exciting part about this is that at a time when the outdoor community, when the outdoor activities are dropping in popularity, this is the one outdoor activity that is showing growth. My generation, Generation X, Generation Y, we are going after muskies because we love it. It's a growth opportunity that we have. This bill in front of you today will cap this opportunity. And I believe that I speak for non-lakeshore owners, but fishermen in this state who are excited about the opportunities and encourage the DNR to continue this growth. We have a great resource that's limited. We have thousands of lakes, and less than 2% of them are stocked with muskies. Some of these lakes are big, which is where these numbers come from, but I assure you, very few amounts of them are. And I would also encourage that while the DNR may have struggled in some different areas, this is one of their golden pieces that they can hold up. Muskie fishing in Minnesota is big time. Rapala, the largest fishing manufacturer in the world, is based out of here. And I talked with their president, Tom Mackin, yesterday, and he can't understand why we would want to not support local businesses, local manufacturers, local resorts, and even simple fishing guides such as myself with limiting our opportunities.
Thank you, Mr. Frank. I have to tell you that I'm not against muskie stocking, and I'm not against muskie fishing, and I think it's a great opportunity. It's just that the people that are on these lakes don't want it to happen. 80% of these folks that were at these town hall meetings did not want this to happen on their lake because there's no muskies in those lakes now. There's other opportunities there, and they just don't want them. This is all about listening to the people that live in that area. That's what this is about. Maybe we can find some other folks or some other lakes that probably do want muskies stocked in their lakes. And this bill, the way it stands now, is not stopping the DNR from stocking other lakes. It's just these five.
I understand that. With respect, I would also say that while the people that live on these lakes represent people that we need to listen to, I have not seen a survey or anything that's been presented by the DNR that says that there's not more people in favor of this than less. Every time I've seen anything put out there, the general fishing public around the state, not necessarily lakeshore owners, they are in favor of this.
Mr. Wagner.
Vern Wagner, Vice President Anglers for Habitat.
He took all your time, so you're done.
That happens to me all the time.
Go ahead,
I came
Vern.
All the way from the North Pole to do this.
Go ahead, Vern.
And So I looked at Gull Lake. I want to make a comment about Gull. Gull is one of the lakes that, you know, we're trying to do something about the infestation, the small northern pike. Gull Lake is one of the lakes that has one of the big problem with small northern pike. We're stocking walleyes up there 3 to 4 times the amount that we would normally stock in a lake that size. And when we DNR test netting shows where we used to be able to do, they used to be able to do test nets, they get 8 or 9 walleyes and 3 or 4 pike. Now that's reversed. We're getting, the data indicates that we sometimes get test nets with 17 small pike and 3 or 4 walleyes. So what's happening is that our stocking on Gull is being really reduced by the small northern pike population. Now, muskies are not the answer to controlling small pike, but they are a little piece of it. Muskies will eat a number of small northern pike. And you may say that they don't, but when we look at lakes that have muskies in them, a third of those lakes don't have the same problems. So they're not a cure-all. They're not an end-all. The second point I wanted to make is that I understand lake owners, when they buy a home and they have the lake, they get this sense of propriety over that lake. It's like coming home and finding 2 cars that you don't recognize parked in front of your house. And it makes you a little uneasy. I understand that. You go, what are those cars out there for? And the same thing happens when lakeshore owners see boats out on their lake that come too close to them and to their property. Now, state law requires that fishing contests cannot usurp public accesses. We cannot use more than 50% of an access. We have to leave half of it. So this idea that we're filling accesses with contest boats, I think is a misunderstanding. They don't know who's there. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Vern. Thank you, Ms. Frank.
Would I be able to add one more final thought?
Go ahead.
Okay. I live on the water, and I'm not trying to sugarcoat this when I say that the lakes that I fish that are stocked with muskies, those are some of the best walleye, bass, panfish lakes in this state. They work very well together, and that's by proof. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to have some of the Lakeshore folks come down from Otter Tail County and Gull Lake Chain, and if you folks can come down and just be very, very. Are you going to speak for the whole group?
I can try.
Yep. Yep. You know, if there's some other folks, be very, very quick. Very, very quick. Because we spent much more time on this than I was planning on doing. I've got 10 other bills to get done, so please, please be brief if you possibly can.
I'm Dave Myshak. I'm president of the Otter Tail COLA, Coalition of Lakes Associations, representing all of Otter Tail County. I'm past president of the Pelican Lake Property Owners Association and a board member of Lake Improvement Districts. Basically, we've had muskie in our lake for 36 years, and the DNR has not managed it properly. They haven't followed the long-range plan. The NAP study that you've heard referenced today, that they sugar-coated and put a new date on of 2012, I call that the wrong fish, wrong size study. It's a 2007 study, and that's their go-to study. That's the study they use to say there's no harm. That's not the case. They used the wrong fish. It was a species of fish before the current Mississippi strain at the wrong size. At that size, at the time that study was done, the fish were 30 inches. They're 54 inches now. They don't have any data on that. The percentage of people that fish muskie is a trumped up number that's exaggerated. We estimate, we had a muskie guide tell us there's 2,000 or 3,000 muskie fishermen in the state. 2,000 or 3,000. Their numbers, including a more recent thing came out today, they're estimated up to 300,000 would like to. We don't usually count lake dues. You either do it or you don't. So that the data and the information that the Minnesota DNR has out there is just inflated, and it's very annoying from a technical standpoint to see the information. The long-range plan, I might also add, that says, states the public has the opportunity to influence decisions that affect them. Again, that's a written statement in the long-range plan. Fish management is based on public input and best available science. They're not listening to us. They don't care what the lake property owners say, and it's not just the property owners. It's all the other fishermen. The muskie fishermen represent probably 2 to 3% of the fish buying licenses in the state. Have them prove their numbers. They've been the fastest growing fishing segment for how many years now? And when Mille Lacs is suffering and nobody goes to Mille Lacs and they've got the best muskie fishing ever, are the muskie fishermen going there and saving that lake? It's time we wake up and listen to the facts and listen to your taxpaying public. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. We have a question, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sir, you just said have them prove their numbers. Do you have any numbers to back up what you're saying?
There's 1,100 Muskie Inc. members in the state. There's 7,500 in the nation, and they're the ones that about half of those that are sending me the emails. We have 500,000 lakeshore property owners in the state, and there's 1.1 million resident fishing license sold in the state. So yes, I have some numbers, and the Muskie guide that told us 2,000 to 3,000 was estimated on the high side.
Also, so, and sir, in follow-up to that, you're basically insinuating every lakeshore property owner, of which my family owns property on multiple lakes, are in support of what you're saying, and they're not.
We have not found one lake association so far, one lake association that supports the Muskie plan in this state. They represent less than 1% of the fishing population. They already have 35% of the surface water, not counting the Mississippi River and everything along the Mississippi River, which they stock and they catch muskie in very heavily. So we need an honest, ethical evaluation of the muskie stocking program in this state. I realize that won't happen today, but it is out of control, and they have raised the attention of some people who care and care a lot. The 500,000 lakeshore property owners of the state will start to be heard.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I still think it's you're reaching pretty far, sir, to say that every cabin owner in lakeshore property owner, the 500,000 people you're referring to, sir, are all in support of you. I've talked to personally over the last few days a number of people who are lakeshore owners who are opposed. I'm sure if you reached out to Lake Vermilion, their association would tell you that they're fully supportive of stocking. And so I think it's very disingenuous for you to get up and speak on behalf of everyone else's community for your own self-serving interests. And I think it's kind of offensive. Why would you come to the legislature and testify on behalf of a bunch of people you haven't talked to?
Mr. Chair, I would say that on our lake we have about 950 residents and about 20 to 30 support. We see support from lakeshore property members consistent with what we believe is the actual number of muskie fishing in the state. So if I implied that it's 100% of the lakeshore property owners today, I apologize for that. That was not the representation I was trying to make. The representation is less than the 5 and even 10%. And I would stake that as a number that we need to start with. Mr. Chair?
Representative Anderson? Or who was that? Representative Metzl, was that you? Okay. Someone else? Representative Anderson, would you like to wrap up your bill? Representative Anderson moves that House File, 3207, as amended, be recommended to pass and be placed on the general register. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. The bill is on its way to the general register. Let's see. Representative Anderson, you have House File 3160?
I do.
Representative Anderson moves House File 3160 be recommended, passed, and placed on the general register. Brian?
Yep.
Okay. Brian Peterson? He's on his way up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Bill number 3160 is a bill that's basically a technical fix for allowing companies like Federal Ammunition, which is a Minnesota-based company, to be able to use night vision goggles and for some of their testing of their equipment. Right now, it is currently a penalty for them to be in possession with them with a firearm at night. And with that, I will give the testimony to our testifier.
Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Mr. Chair, committee, my name is Brian Peterson. I'm senior engineer at Federal Ammunition in Anoka, Minnesota here.
Okay.
I'll try to abide by your 2 minutes, Mr. Chair, on this. Very simply, this is a technical fix, we believe. As you may know, we employ about 1,800 people in the Anoka, Minnesota here facility, making ammunition for a wide variety of clients, anywhere from law enforcement to military to commercial ammunition. So. It is an impact to our business. Many of the military contracts, LE contracts, do require nighttime shooting. There are tracer technologies. There are implications where we need to utilize these night vision and thermal devices in order to even see some of the ammunition we shoot. And so, thus the impact is we're kind of precluded from those areas of business. So, that's really the business side. The other side is the technology itself, I guess, what? Extends beyond Federal Ammunition. Federal Ammunition is a subsidiary or a company is under the Vista Outdoors umbrella. Vista Outdoors has companies called...
No, no, go ahead.
Sorry. Bushnell, Night Optics. We have companies that actually specifically sell this technology as well. And it's becoming more and more of an everyday type technology. Cell phone cases such as this unit right here that fits on an iPhone is a thermal device. Technically right now I would not be able to possess this and a firearm at the same time. So
just to give you... takes care of that problem?
Yes. So... Absolutely. So.
Very, very good. Thank you very much for your testimony. Colonel Smith? Yep. Sorry, we're trying to be brief. Got a lot to get through. We've got some important bills down the road here. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Rodman Smith, Director of DNR Enforcement. Mr. Chair, to the bill. Mr. Chair, we don't believe that this is a technical fix because this would be allowing people to take unprotected or wild animals that are not protected by law with the use of night vision. It also opens up so that anybody can, about 2 years ago, this body did pass the language that's being struck here that would allow now anybody to possess night vision when they had firearms out of doors. We had a lengthy discussions in this committee a couple years ago about the detriment to potential wildlife populations if that happened in poaching. So if this is a technical fix and this is for to allow industry to do some research, we'd be more than happy to work with the author to provide some exception to this law for research purposes through for business. But the way we read it now, it's a little bit more than a technical fix.
Okay. Any other comments, Representative Anderson?
Mr. Chair, no, I think that the way that that this thing was written was specifically just to allow the people at Federal Ammunition to do what they'd like to do for their testing.
Colonel Smith, can you work maybe with Federal Cartridge and maybe come up with some kind of compromise if this isn't exactly what we need to get done?
Absolutely, yes, sir.
Thank you very much. For the time being, we're going to... Representative Considine, you have a question for Colonel Smith?
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Colonel Smith,
and I think Tony, or I'm sorry, Representative Cornish knows the people I'm referring to just outside of Mankato. Would this be something that a poacher would use then? Colonel, if they were trying to do it in the middle of the night?
Colonel Smith.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, and that's why this language was put into law here a couple years ago.
Very well. Representative Anderson, you can work with the Colonel and Federal Cartridge, and if there's any changes that need to be made, you can make them on the House floor.
I can do that. Thank you.
Very good. Representative Anderson moves that House File 3160 be recommended to pass and placed on the General Register. All in favor of that motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed. Motion prevails. The bill is on the General Register. Okay. Next on the agenda is House File 2819. Representative Jaskowski, the chair will move House File 2819 to bring the bill before us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Before you is House File 2819. It simply attempts to reinsert the ability for people who would like to hunt predators, the ability to use night vision to do it. A constituent of mine brought this issue before me. He is here with me today, Mr. DeWitts, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Drazkowski. And my full motion is to House File 2819 be held over for possible inclusion in the Game and Fish Bill. Please welcome to the committee and state your name for the record.
Thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak before you. I'm Charles DeWitts. I'm from Rochester, Minnesota. I'm not affiliated with any other group or any organization. I'm just here on my own behalf. I've owned night vision scopes for about 15 years, and I've hunted with them for about 10 years. I started hunting coyotes at night. It was purely for recreation. I always had heard about the problems that people could have with coyotes, but me living in the city at the time, I never really had any issues of my own. 11 years ago, my wife and I moved from the city out into the country, and now we raise Black Angus cattle. We do what is called a cow-calf operation. Last year was our first issue with the coyotes. We lost a calf to a coyote, a newborn calf. We had never lost a calf in 7 years. We lost our first calf to a coyote last year. We also had a problem with the coyotes. They got into our pen of our bred cows up to our barn. Got them all wound up, chased them through a fence. It took our veterinarian to come out and stitch the cow back together. She's doing fine now. Everything's okay, but it was the coyotes in the pen that had caused the problem. We don't trap coyotes on our property because my wife and I have pets. We have dogs. We don't want a dog to get in a trap. We don't want our animals to have that happen. We don't want our neighbors' animals to be caught in a trap meant for a different animal, a coyote. I don't like the idea of hunting at night with a light, which is legal now through certain times of the year. I don't believe that. I think my neighbors, when they see a light, the first thing they think of is that I'm poaching or something illegal is going on. I don't like the idea with a light with just shining their eyes and then think you're going to shoot at eyes. You don't know what eyes are when you're using a light. I think to me that we have all these predators out there that are causing problems. I think that with the technology the way it is now with the night vision, that we ought to be able to use our technology that we have to control some of the problems that's out there with the coyotes. And give us a chance to get outside with recreation and enjoy our hobbies. It didn't used to be illegal to hunt with night vision. Like I hunted in Minnesota for 10 years with night vision. It wasn't illegal. My good buddy up here, he's the only other one I know that's got it. We'd go out at night and we'd hunt. It was no different than deer camp and the camaraderie that goes with deer hunting. We were just hunting coyotes at night. Safety-wise, I think that night vision is safer than hunting, I guess, any other way at night. I can't imagine any of you probably have ever used night vision, but it's very easy to identify your target with these newer generation night scopes that are out there. You can see what you're looking at. You can see what the crosshairs are on. You're not shooting at eyes. You're not shooting at a dark spot in the woods. So I think safety-wise, that the night vision, I don't think you can beat it. There are 35 states that I had counted, trying to do a little bit of research before I got here. I do understand that my information was 5 years old. I'll have to tell you that, but the five-year-old information that I got showed 35 states. It's legal to hunt with a night vision scope, either unrestricted or with some restrictions attached to it. It's a hobby that we've always done. It's always been legal. I don't know what happened when the DNR brought it before you. Granted, I probably should have known. I didn't know there was a bill that they were going to try to ban the night vision, or I would have been here when they talked about it before. I can't see that this is just going to be a rampage and we're all going to go out and poach everything out there. It doesn't happen that way. We're legal. We abide by the law. We want to do it legal. That's why we would like to get this stricken, this ban, and go out and be able to pursue our hobby in a legal manner. And I guess if you got any questions for me, I'd be happy to. Oh, and I did bring, like I said, I don't think any of you have probably, I can't imagine, used one before. But I just did bring my, this is what they physically look like. This would be a night vision scope. And this is a third generation scope here. So just to give you an idea what we're even talking about, this is what they are.
Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair, members, now that it jogs my memory, I don't know why I forgot, but I think it was a DNR initiative. I don't know if it was Colonel Ham or who was in charge then, but brought it to us to ban night vision equipment.
We're going to have Colonel Smith come up right now.
Hunting, and we put quite a lot of time on it. Just the opposite of what this one is doing here. So
maybe we could have Colonel Smith come up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, for the record, Rodman Smith, Director of Enforcement, DNR. Mr. Chair, we're opposed to this legislation for a couple of reasons. Number one, first and foremost, the safety concerns that we have with it. Some of the tenets of firearm safety is being sure of your target and what's beyond it. Hunting at night does take on a little different set of circumstances for being able to clearly identify a target and what is beyond it. Normally, predator hunting or coyote hunting is done with a fresh snow and a full moon. It's almost like daylight out there. When you start getting into scopes and using night vision, you're not, depending on the technology, you're not always be able to tell what that target really is. You'll see an outline. So we are opposed to it because of the safety aspects of it. Also, we did last year, or I should say this body did last year, add thermal imaging equipment to this language because of the poaching ramifications with hunting at night. And then lastly, just because I know time is short, and I'll try to keep this short, one of the concerns we also have is in line 1.24, predator in state statute is defined as wolf, fox, coyote, lynx, and bobcat. A couple of those animals are federally protected. And so this would allow at some point to allow the use of night vision for species other than coyotes that we have a special concern over.
Very good. Thank you for your testimony. With that, Representative Drazkowski, I'm going to hold your bill over for possible inclusion in the Game and Fish Bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for coming.
I would just mention quickly,
sure,
and we can adjust that language accordingly down the road if need be. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Very good. Thank you. And thank you for your testifier, too. Very good job. Thank you. At this time, I'm going to... Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Russo.
Just while they're coming up, I'll make a comment. So
okay, go ahead.
Just one of my concerns would be that the use of the night vision would, I believe, make it somewhat more likely that, well, first of all, it would make it more likely somebody was hunting at night without the full moon, and then in consequence of that, make it more likely to mistakenly, accidentally, illegally shoot a wolf. Because you wouldn't be able to tell the difference between them unless you're very, very careful.
Thank you. Representative Erickson, I'm going to put Representative Anderson ahead of you very, very quickly because I think she can get, so she can do hers and then get back to her committee. Representative Anderson, I will move House File 1182 be recommended pass and be referred to the Committee on Civil Law and Data Practices.
And Mr. Chair, I have a delete everything amendment.
Okay. I will move the, is it a DE1?
Yeah.
Move the DE1 amendment to get the shape that, get the bill in the shape that you'd like. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, motion prevails. The bill is in the shape that you'd like.
Just briefly, Mr. Chair, what this allows for folks to do is on their online applications for fishing or hunting licenses, they would be able to access information on providing organ donation that they would be able to participate in. That's all that it does. This has been worked with the agencies involved, and everyone is, if you can bear with me, peace in the valley on the issue. So I do have a testifier here if she wants to briefly comment.
Okay, very good. Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Susan Mal Larson. I serve as the Director of Partner and Community Relations for LifeSource, and I'm here to express our support for 1182. You heard this bill last year and passed it, and since that time, as Representative Anderson said, we've collaborated with DNR and are returning with, I think, new and improved language that would allow for individuals obtaining their hunting and fishing license to register as donors. Minnesotans register as donors at a very high rate, but we know that there's more that we need to do, and coupling donor registration in this form with hunting and fishing license provides a unique means for us to increase the number of people who are registered as donors and the number of lives saved through transplantation. You will notice that the language directs LifeSource to reimburse the agency for their programming costs so that there wouldn't be any kind of burden to the agency or to the applicant. This bill is also supported by Medical Alley and by Mayo Clinic. So that's all I have to say. Thank you, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Very good. Any questions, members? We heard this bill last year, and it's a good bill, and it's improved, so very good. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Steve Michaels, DNR. Minnesota DNR, did you have something to say? Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Mr. Chair, members, Steve Michaels, Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. I'm the Electronic Licensing System Program Director. And yes, we've worked with the organization, and we're set to go.
Very good. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Any further discussion? Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, just because I'm on the Civil Law Committee, it's got some data privacy issues. Is this going to be going to have to go to Civil Law?
That's where we're sending it. All in favor of the motion to pass House File 1182 as amended to Civil Law, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. The bill is on its way to Civil Law.
Thank you,
Representative Anderson. Representative Erickson. Representative Wood.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move Representative Erickson's bill, House File 3458, for consideration.
And we're going to move the bill to the Committee on Job Growth, Energy, and Affordable Policy and Finance. That's where we're going to head the bill. Thank you very much, Representative Erickson. Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have an amendment, A2 as well.
Okay. Which one?
To get the bill in the shape that we'd like to have when it comes to jobs.
Representative Lewick moves the A2 amendment to get the bill in the shape that Representative Erickson would like. All in favor of that motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Two-year bill is amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Committee 3458 as amended is in response to the decisions made by the DNR and to the request made by Governor Dayton for a special session after the DNR in early August closed the a walleye season on Lake Mille Lacs. Mr. Chair and members, only Section 1 is applicable in this committee, and that is the Lake Mille Lacs Area Economic Relief Program, as it's entitled, and a definition of the relief program with the request that Mille Lacs Lake develop and operate the Lake Mille Lacs Economic Relief Program. There is available relief in the form of grants, in the form of interest-free or forgivable loans if they do not exceed $100,000, and for tourism promotion, and of course reimbursement to counties if they grant abatement or refunds on the statewide business property tax. So with that, Mr. Chair, and the amendments in place, with acknowledgement that we want DEED to audit this program, I think I'll proceed to my testifiers. Thank you very much, committee.
Thank you. Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Tina Chapman, and I am the Executive Director of Mille Lacs Area Tourism Council, and I am also a resort owner on Mille Lacs Lake. As Representative Erickson mentioned, We were kicked in the teeth last August with an unprecedented walleye closure. We were double kicked this winter with late ice, of course, and then we anticipated generating operating income when we had a one fish walleye season, but unfortunately that didn't happen for most. And now yesterday we were kicked in the teeth hard again with a catch and release open water season with no use of live bait and a full season 10 p.m. night ban. It's another unprecedented move which will bring even more economic devastation to the area. We simply have no teeth left. The unfortunate part is we expect to have a phenomenal bite this summer, but we need 70% of the people to stay home, otherwise we're at risk of closure. That's pretty sad. We can market the heck out of our area, but if we have nothing for people to come to, then the marketing dollars are wasted. Economic relief for the area goes hand in hand with the tourism dollars. These struggles haven't just been happening since August. It's been ongoing continually and has continually increased over the last few years as the regulations have continued to tighten. And Karen will speak to some of these issues.
So, Mr. Chair, I'm Karen McCoyd. I'm a resort owner on Mille Lacs. Okay. I'm also the chairman of the Tourism Council and on our local school board. So, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thanks for hearing us. I know that we've been in front of you several times. I have quite a file of notes from each time we come to testify here. What we're saying again is that economic relief for businesses is desperately needed to survive and thrive. Businesses right now, especially resort business in this instance, are making minimal, if any, improvements, and many are unable to make their full payments. In addition to that, however, the trickle-down effect, our communities are having a hard time keeping and attracting residents. The school district that I serve is having a difficult time with budget because we continue to lose students. As those employees don't stay in the area, as the dollars aren't there, they move somewhere else, and we continue to lose students. Younger generations are not staying in the local communities because of issues and a lack of full-time jobs. The struggles, like Tina said, have been ongoing. And let me say that, keep in mind, the press that you read from various resorters yesterday was pretty much putting a positive spin on the press. Remember that we also have to still try to attract those people to come to the lake. But behind doors, behind closed doors, every one of the businesses is negatively impacted. Bottom line, our message is we need this economic relief as soon as possible. We need to be honest here and say that business conditions continue to deteriorate, and we have to balance that with the message of trying to promote what's left on the lake. I'd like to also mention that the value of this entire bill is critical to us. The economic relief that will be afforded as part of the tax abatement, my taxes for my property tax represent about this much cost, bottom line, to my business. The amount of money that I lost just this winter season because of the conditions there, the regulations on the ice, the amount of revenue we lost just in the ice fishing portion of our business is about triple that. So the numbers just continue to decline, and tax abatement is important, but the economic relief is more important. As an aside, let me mention, I grew up on the Iron Range. So that area is definitely hurting. Talk about jumping from the frying pan into the fire. I'm now a Mille Lacs business owner. So if we can just conclude that investing in the Mille Lacs area is a valuable investment, not only for the Mille Lacs area, and that's not just the people right on the lake, but you'll learn that it's a broader range of businesses. But it's an investment for all Minnesotans, because when people want to visit, even if it isn't until the lake comes back, when they come back, there'll be something to visit. There will be businesses that have been able to survive and keep their doors open and perhaps make sure that those doors aren't hanging by one hinge. Thank you for your time, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Commissioner, state your name and who you represent.
I'm Dave Oslin, Mille Lacs County Commissioner, 5th District. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Erickson, for this opportunity today. And I would just like to add to the conversation here that the relief is very needed. In regards to Mille Lacs County and the tax base and the makeup. My district alone, I serve four townships that all border Mille Lacs Lake, Iowaukon and Onamia. And my district alone accounts for more than one-third of the tax base for Mille Lacs County. And we're hurting. Just In the last year, I've dropped over $26 million in value because of the lakeshore properties and things. And I can only speak for Mille Lacs County. The other two counties, Aiken and Crow Wing, I don't know their figures, but the Mille Lacs community, as we speak about as a whole, is really in trouble up there economically. So I just want you folks to keep in mind that about the county's concerns and interests here. Thank you.
Questions, members? Representative Lewitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I would like to add to Commissioner's comments. I can speak for Crow Wing and Aiken County. That's part of High and Representative Erickson Share, Mille Lacs Lake, and ditto, same thing. We've got Garrison, we've got Wealthwood, we've got Malmo, we've got Glenn, all the way around the lake. We're having issues here, and it spreads out well beyond just the lakeshore. It goes back a township or two, so I will absolutely second Commissioner Osborne's comments. They apply to Aiken and Crow Wing County also.
Representative Russo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we've heard about how widespread the effects are and how some businesses are really drastically affected. And I'm concerned about the benefit being spread too thinly. So looking at line 2.2, I'm curious, there's no threshold of what size of loss a business has experienced. It's merely a reduction in gross receipts in any two-year period. And that's any two-year period, not even necessarily the last two-year period. So I'm wondering why that is phrased the way it is. It seems excessively broad, and it's going to, you know, I think, why aren't we targeting the hardest-hit people?
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Russo. We decided to look back to 2010 because that is the most critical, the beginning of the most critical time for the businesses that surround the lake. I think maybe you could comment further, Ms.
Thank you for your question, Representative Russo. Some of the data that we have shows that this deterioration has gone on for quite some time. In 2013, one of the Explore Minnesota Tourism surveys showed that the businesses in the area were down nearly 60% for occupancy and revenue. Last year, our survey showed just as a result of the closure, we were down again. But the point is that a lot of us have continued to try to be creative in our marketing and in our efforts. So, for example, my father-in-law owns a motel and a launch business. And so for him to demonstrate that percentage, it might need to go back farther, because while his walleye business has deteriorated, he invested some more money into building up a couple more launches so that he could take advantage of the smallmouth fishery and target a different fish population. And so some of the costs are offset with some of the other investments that he was able to make.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Russell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, well, it seems to me if someone has had a 60% reduction in business, that's clearly a crying need. If somebody's had a 50% reduction in business, that's a crying need. 20% reduction, we have to look, you know, that's still big. We got to start balancing factors. If somebody's been able to offset it by shifting their business plan, great. So, but why are we including the ability of someone who's had a quarter of 1% reduction in gross receipts to qualify for a $100,000 lower or interest-free loan for their business at the expense of everybody in the state, all the other businesses in the state that may have also have wobbles in their business? So this is, I'm not getting at the merits of the whole program, just that one line that seems to me excessively broad, and that we really ought to think about some balance on that and put some kind of threshold on that.
Mr. Chair, well, we did have a threshold, and then after further research, we lifted that. This is really local control. We have chosen among the three counties to make Mille Lacs County the fiscal agent and to be the determiner of who will qualify. And so when you get right down to it, there's going to be a relationship between Deed and Mille Lacs County and Crow Wing and Aiken as well. But Mille Lacs County's
administrator as the lead in determining who will qualify and to what extent. So I think we have that covered, but as this bill moves, if we want to return to our 5% as we had, and I think Mr. Klayman could address some of that as he's worked with me on this proposal. But I think that that's what we want. We want to keep it very local to the extent we can with parameters designed between DEED and the county administrator who will be acting as the determiner along with representatives from Crowing and Aiken as they make the decisions.
Are there yours?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I appreciate that. I think that, you know, to satisfy the interests of the state, and it's not local money, and so there's a balance between local control and making things fair across the entire state, because we have other regions that have had downturns in business also that might be looking at this a little bit askance. Thank you.
Representative Anzel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. McCoyd, you've done a really good job of convincing us that this is has merit, and I'm pretty confident that the Rangers are going to support you.
And once a Ranger.
And perhaps you should come back down here and use your immense skills and talent and help us with our colleagues to pass our unemployment compensation bill as well.
Well, Representative Anzel, we can talk about that. Any further discussion? Representative Eckman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Erickson, would you be open to maybe expanding this? And I'm thinking of Northern Aiken County, some of the small mom-and-pop operations that are losing out on business also because of the range unemployment. The people aren't traveling to these small resorts, and that's through no fault of their own also.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Erickson.
Representative, you know, what we've tried to focus on here is loss of business due to management by the DNR. And so we believe that when a state agency might be bearing the responsibility for some of what's happened around the lake, that's what we need to focus on, what has happened in regard to Lake Mille Lacs as a great fishery in the state. So to the extent we can extend that, you know, it's more costly. We have done the calculations for a major part of the areas. In fact, I can show you the circled area. If we look at this, we'd be up in Palisade, and we'd be over in Representative Anderson's area of Bay Lake. So, you know, we've done calculations, and I started out using funding from natural resources and game and fish until there was pushback about that, because I didn't want to dip into the budget surplus that we have. Then I moved to unclaimed prize money from the lottery and undesignated money from the lottery. Representative Anzel's questioned me when I moved my bill to another committee on the floor. And I explained to him, as he questioned me, that we were looking at the revenue source first so that we could determine what is affordable for this dilemma that we're in. And so then finally, after discussions, we've moved to trying to use some of the budget surplus. And I feel bad about that, because I think when this is a natural resource and we've had management of this resource that even the DNR now has questioned, that we need to hold, you know, an area of funding that's aligned with natural resources accountable. So we know we're happy to add as much as we can, but we have to be able to afford this. And I think the most needy are those who encircle the lake, who have businesses in Aiken, Crowing, and Mille Lacs that have been directly affected by this. And maybe there are others who want to make comments.
Representative Mesa.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And what is the total amount available?
I think I'll call on Mr. Klayman. Can you provide us with some information there?
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, Representative Metza, there is an appropriation from the general fund for $10 million per year.
For 3 years.
For 3 years.
Representative Metza.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, it is concerning to me that, you know, Representative Anzels might have brought it up lightheartedly, but you're asking us to give $30 million to a few resort owners, and we're asking for $27 million for unemployment extensions for folks on the range. that affect 6,690 families right now and growing, and it's become a political football. We've got a huge downturn in our mom-and-pop small resorts around the area. If you want to say mismanaged by the legislature, I think that would be the case for my constituents. I'm just confused as to why we would give that much money. Is there any, getting to my actual question, so if a resort were to take a low-interest loan and went bankrupt, is there any recourse for the state to get their money back? Or how would that work?
Mr. Chair, and I think that's a question that's going to be discussed in the Jobs Committee. We want to deal with the policy here. And so the finance will be dealt with in both the Tax Committee and in the Jobs Committee. So if you could stick to the policy, I think that's more appropriate here. The funding is yet to come, and you know, I'm sure there's going to be a lot of discussion about that in the next committee. Yes, and Ms. McCoy?
Any additional, Representative Metza?
May I answer one question, Chairman?
McQuaid.
Representative Metza, you mentioned that it was this aid would be going to the resorts, and I just wanted to clarify that this aid is not just for the resorts, it's for the resorts, the other businesses, and it's not just Mille Lacs, it's a wider range, but it is not just directed at resort owners.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Follow up. How many businesses in total would that be then, seeing as you've got a good diagram there?
Ms. McQuaid.
The number is going to depend on the radius around the lake. Mr. Clayman has looked at how affordable it is, whether we go 10, 15, or 20 miles radius.
Let's assume the 20.
I don't have that number.
No, I don't think he does.
Representative Metza,
Deed knows this number because during our working group in preparation for a possible special session, that was discussed. And I think it's about 100 businesses that are affected if you go to the 20-mile radius, and it's about 50 to 60 if we stay within the radius that now is in the bill.
And that is important to point out that a lot of these terms were discussed during the legislative working group. In discussions with Deed, this is sort of where we came to on these terms and the radius of applicability.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, what does concern me, I do remember that exact conversation. I remember asking Deed as well to provide a circle with a 10, 15, and 20-mile radius around my district, where the mining companies are located, basically from the plant at MinTac and the plant at HibTac, respectively. And we have, I think it was in the thousands of businesses who are affected. And so, you know, I just really have a hard time not with helping on this issue. I think that we should help, but I think that you should know, and your friends back home should know, that my constituents, at least at a 10 to 1, if not probably 20 or 30 to 1 in number of businesses affected, are being treated pretty egregiously by the legislature this year in terms of them getting the relief they need. And it's become a political football for months. I don't intend on making it that for you today. I do think that we have a need. But I think it's a fair discussion for you to have back home with your community members, to have conversations with their legislators about dropping the politics when folks are in trouble, and, you know, putting that aside and just getting on with helping folks when they need it. And I think that's the intent of this bill. But I did want to point out the irony, seeing as we have the most serious economic downturn that we've seen in generations, which you're experiencing on your lake. And actually, my parents, I'm proud we restored a Mille Lacs fishing boat, one of the big old white ones, and it's sitting right now next to our family's coffee shop up in Cook, Minnesota, as a place where you can go out, and it's still got the name on the boat, and folks can enjoy a little bit of Mille Lacs in Cook, Minnesota, right there. But again, you know, in all seriousness, this is about priorities, and we come down here to make tough decisions. And I don't mean this to be offensive towards your community whatsoever. My parents have a small fishing resort up on Pelican Lake, and or their business is down drastically right now because we're not the Lake Vermilion, you know, $3,000 a week for the stay. We're $700. You know, local family can come and afford it. Right now, our local families up north can't afford to take those vacations. So I hope you'll encourage your legislators to support decisive, quick action on getting those benefits out of my community as well.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Metzer, remember it's compromise, and I think what's happened on the House floor, we've demonstrated that we want to compromise. So we get a little bit, and you're going to get a lot. We want that to work together. So I hope that's how we proceed.
Representative Metzer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just wondering what you meant by a lot.
Representative Wulick renews his motion that House File 3458 be recommended to pass as amended and re-referred to the Committee on Job Growth and Energy Affordability Policy and Finance. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, motion prevails. The bill is on its way.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Representative Fabian, please be quick. Chairman moves House File 3022 to get the bill before us, and we're going to send this bill to the General Register. Okay. Representative Fabian, please proceed with your bill. Please ask your testifiers to be very, very, very brief. We have a couple of more bills to do after yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, I'd like to move the DE1 amendment.
The chair will move the DE1 amendment to get the shape in the bill, the bill in the shape that the author would like. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, motion prevail. The bill is in the shape that you like.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I do have one technical question for Ms. Taylor. Ms. Taylor, on lines 1.19, after the word crop, we want to make sure that forage is also included in the language because that's what has happened in the past, which would be hay and silage and stuff. Would crop cover that, or do we need to have that technical adjustment to the bill? And it would also have to happen then on line 1.24.
Ms. Taylor?
Mr. Chair, members, I believe it would be covered, but if the committee wanted to make sure, we could add hay in those two locations. But the crop and fence damage, that's the language used in that particular statute, so that would just keep it consistent.
Mr. Chair, and it's just I just want to make sure that it's the legislative intent of my bill to make sure that the forages are covered as well.
Okay.
So
we've got it covered. Yeah, we move the amendment. There was only one amendment, right? Okay.
Yep.
Okay, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, let me start out by saying I don't think that we would be here today with this bill if the DNR was doing a better job of listening to the people up in Kitson County who are greatly impacted.
Were you here earlier? Apparently you weren't here. Okay, go ahead.
I'm hearing that
in a lot of communities these days.
I was in committee this morning too, sir. Basically what the report does, in Section 1, Subdivision 8, the Commission of Agriculture is required to submit a report to the chairs of the House of Representatives, Senate, and committees, House and Senate committees and divisions with jurisdiction over agriculture, environment, natural resources by December 15th of each year, that lists the total damages created by the elk herd in the two fiscal years. And if you remember back in 2000, then the elk management plan is in Section 2. In 2014, item 4 was removed from that language, and that language number 4 said that it had to restrict the elk to non-agricultural land in the state. That was removed in 14. I think that the producers will tell you that there was really never much of a serious effort made to keep the elk off of private land and on state land. So then the next part of the bill, you know, the DNR is going around now having hearings or listening sessions about the possibility of expanding the elk herd. We do not want the elk herd to be expanded until the DNR has put the practices in place that they say that they can put in place and shown that they have reduced or minimized the damage to crops and fences and forage for at least 2 years. And then at the end of that time period, 60 days prior to implementing any kind of a plan that would increase the elk herd, The Commissioners of Natural Resources and DNR would be required to have a public hearing, joint hearing, in the county where the elk herd is to be located and increased. And at that meeting, they have to present evidence that crop and fence damages have not increased in the prior 2 years. So that's the essence of my bill, Mr. Chair. I've got some people that came down. If you think I have a long travel back and forth to Roseau, Mr. Schmiederberg's is substantially longer than mine.
Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee, and Representative Fabian. My name is Donnie Schmiederberg. I'm a cow-calf producer in Kitson County. I'm a small producer, but I'm trying to represent the views of a lot of cattle producers and crop farmers up in that area of the state. The number of elk have grown pretty much every year. In the old management plan that the DNR had, our population goal for the Kitson County herd was 20 to 30 elk, and in the last 6 years, the herd has been above that 30 every year. So this bill would really help challenge the DNR to manage the elk more away from the ag land and the cattle type land, whether it be pastures and forage fields and things like that. I just think that there needs to be more effort to change the way the elk depend on the farmer to feed them. I've had elk in my stored feed, mostly stored hay, grazing in my forage acres, breaking through fences for several years. The issue isn't with the few elk, it's with a large group of elk. They do a tremendous amount of damage, and it can be very devastating to producers. I know several producers that struggle almost daily at certain times of the year with problems with the depredation and fence damage. I know there's a program in place for depredation. It's a very frustrating process to go through. Takes a while for the right person to come out and go over your claim with you, and then you may wait several months to be paid or reimbursed for that. And I think I speak for just about everyone who's ever went through a claim process that you're probably only reimbursed about 30% of your actual damage. And by that I mean there's always time and effort that you don't get paid for. For example, I have fence that borders a state highway. When the elk knock down the fence, if I have cattle that get out, that's my responsibility. I take that very seriously, and I don't want to be liable for somebody having a accident with one of my cows on the highway, so I check that fence daily during the grazing season. I do not get compensated for that extra time. I do get compensated for the repairs of the fence, but that is it. Another example of that would be when you harvest a field and you know the elk have been out in that crop, say it be a sunflower or a soybean field, there's always obvious damage. You can go through the process and be reimbursed for that obvious damage, and then you go out to harvest the field, and a quarter mile from, you know, where the claim site was, you find other areas. Those producers don't shut down harvest and wait a week for the adjuster to come out and look at that damage and make those claims. They continue on, you know, especially the people that hire custom combiners. They're out there. They say, oh, there's, you know, a big bare spot in your bean field. You know, do we go around it? No, you know, they don't go around it. They harvest the field and you're done. So there's some issues with the depredation process. To that, there's a perception that the producers are all against the elk, and that's not the case. We don't disagree that they're a unique resource to the state and to our area, but at the same point, same time, we just want the DNR to manage them according to how they say they're going to manage them and make the effort, put the resources into it that needs to be put into it to deter them from the ag land and onto the state land. They own over 70,000 acres in our county and have very, very few food plot acres on their land. You know, they're really relying on the farmer to feed these animals, and it's a big burden for many, many producers. Like I said, this bill would really help, and we have a lot of support locally for it. I thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair. Representative Fame, a few words. Please state your name and who you represent for the record. Please try to keep it brief.
All right.
We've got two more bills to do, and we were done about 3 minutes ago.
All right, we'll try. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Committee, thank you for allowing me to say a few words.
Thank
My
you.
Name is Dan. Pardon?
Nothing.
My name is Dan Anderson, and I represent Minnesota State Cattlemen's Association as Region 1 Director up in the area where these three elk herds are. I also farm, raise beef cattle up there. I've been to all the informational meetings up there, and I've talked to dozens of producers, heard a lot of talk about it, and depredation is certainly the number one issue, and one of the reasons this is, of course, is some lack of management or mismanagement on the part of the DNR. In 1987, there was a plan that tried to settle this. Depredation has been a problem forever since the state reintroduced the elk up there. You know, many of you don't probably weren't around, or some of you weren't in '75 when a local farmer shot five elk out of his hay pile because he was just frustrated and tired of feeding the elk. You know, sometime after that, the elk legislation came into effect, first in '85 to try to move them out of the area. In '87. The statute that we're talking about here that was revised 2 years ago came into effect, and it was a compromise between farmers and DNR to try to find a common ground to keep the elk. We understand they're valuable, but to also respect the rights of the cattle producers and the farmers, and so this adding this language to the bill is going to restore some balance to that statute. I feel it's going to give, you know, some protection to the farmers, and it also leaves open the possibility for the DNR to increase their elk herd if they want, but they have to do it in a way where it doesn't negatively impact us. And the other concern we have, and I'll try to make this quick, but I live, or my operation is about 15 miles north of the Grigla Elk Range. Many of you remember this 10 years ago. We went through a terrible time with a TB outbreak up in northwest Minnesota. And I'm actually in that core zone there, or the management zone. It was a devastating time. It cost the state a lot of money. And having elk and cattle close to each other, and if they're close together, they're going to get together. They're going to eat from the common food stuff, and this is a disaster for, if there is any kind of a disease outbreak, when you mix wildlife and cattle together, it's like pouring gas on a fire. It just creates 10 times the problem it would have been if it would have been just in the cattle, if you got, you know, cross-contamination there with these diseases. And so, yes, the State Cattlemen's Association is very concerned about this practice going on where cattle, elk are able to come into farmers' cattle areas. So that's the other thing I just wanted to mention, that is another big concern of ours. And also, I mentioned the you know, the Minnesota TB outbreak up in Manitoba. On you know, the one of these herds goes back and forth into Manitoba, and they're just trying to get over a TB outbreak there that's been between the elk and the cattle. So it's not a new problem, and I don't think we need to or want to risk that in our, you know, here. So with that, I'll go ahead. Thank you.
Questions, members? Thank you very much for your testimony. With that, the chair will move that House file. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, the DNR wanted to come forward. Could you please come down? I forgot. Mr. Thielander. Well, Mr. Thielander's coming down. We're going to be laying over for possible consideration at another time, another meeting, hopefully next week. House file 2674, Lewick, and House file 3382, Hackbarth, will be taking up at another time. So if there's folks here that wanted to testify to those bills, it's the House file 2674 and House file 3382. We'll not be taking those up today. There's two other bills on the calendar that we will do if we ever get out of here. So, Mr. Thielander, please state your name and who you represent for the record.
My name is Paul Thielander, DNR Wildlife Section Chief. And
thank you,
Mr. Chair and committee members, for this chance to testify. And just want to respond and kind of provide the DNR's perspective on this bill. Back in 2009, Minnesota DNR completed the first ever elk management plan in Minnesota using a public process, and that plan covered the period from 2010 to 2015. We implemented many of the plan objectives, including we managed hunting seasons to reduce or maintain elk populations in the goal range, obtain legislative approval to increase the amount of funding available per producer to protect stored forage, obtain legislative approval to provide funding to address pasture fence damage, issued shooting permits in response to severe summer crop damage situations, and removed a group of elk of captive herd origin in the Lancaster area. Near the end of this March, now 2016, we plan to complete our final revised version of the Minnesota Elk Plan, which will cover the period from 2016 through 2019. That'll be a four-year plan. The plan revision involved extensive public review process during the past 2 years, including the formation of two local elk work groups, one for the Kitson County elk and one for the Griddle area elk, that met three times each to provide recommendations on the draft plan. We issued news releases and conducted three public meetings to obtain input on the draft plan, solicited and received online comments of the plan through the use of a DNR email address. And this is simply the opinion of people who took time to comment. We normally use random mail surveys to determine actual population preference, but nonetheless, we did have a website for input. And following the input period, 63% of respondents thought our population goals were too low, 26% were supportive of the population goals outlined in the plan, and 11% thought the goals were too high. And most of the people that was mentioned earlier here by other testifiers who thought the goals were too high were those in the elk range areas. DNR plans to continue to work with landowners to better address crop degradation issues, including identifying locations for and establishing more food plots on both public and private lands. The DNR also initiated an elk research project just last month in February and fitted 20 cow elk with radio collars aimed at increasing our understanding of elk movements and habitat use, and also improving ways to address depredation issues. The DNR is also working with the University of Minnesota to develop a mail survey of Northwest landowners examining attitudes towards elk, and this will be a random mail survey and should shed light on how the majority of landowners feel about elk, not just those who might have completed an online survey. And lastly, Northwest Minnesota elk have only been hunted since 1987, and experience has shown that hunting has instilled more wary behavior in these animals. This behavior can help to reduce crop depredation. Higher population levels, although still limited, would provide more hunting and viewing opportunity, which would help to maintain or increase this wary behavior. And then on the back of your handout, I did provide a summary of elk damage claims for crop damage that have been paid from 1993 through the first half of fiscal 2016, would be through last December. And that's displayed both in table and graph format there for your information. And then just a note at the bottom that plan goals in the new plan would be 30 to 38 in the Griggler, which is unchanged, 50 to 60 in the Lancaster herd, which would be up from 20 to 30 in the current plan. And then I would also note that our current estimate last month was 53 animals, so that population's in that range right now. And then the caribou vita herd, which is the one that goes back and forth between Manitoba and Kitson County, at 150 to 200, which is unchanged. So That completes my testimony. If there's questions, I'd be happy to try to answer those.
Thank you. Questions, members? Representative Fabian?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Mr. Thielander makes my case for me. He said right now that the herd is basically double what it was before. They're operating under the current management plan, and the elk herd has increased. They've got elk research going on. They say that they can do food plots. The simple gist of my bill is let's put those other practices in place, and then if they do work, like they say it will work, then we can have a discussion about raising the number of elk. He's already admitted that the number of elk has increased there. I think that they've done a poor job of listening to the people up there and responding to their concerns, and with that, I conclude my remarks, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Thielander?
Mr. Chair, I just want to respond. I did mention purposely that the last survey showed an estimate of 53 elk in that Lancaster area. The previous 3 years, however, we had numbers in low to mid-30s. And I think our research project will shed light on movement and possible mixing of those populations. It's very possible that elk from that caribou vita herd may have been in the area of the Lancaster herd during our survey. So there's lots of things we can learn from the research project. I just want to point out that our estimates in the prior 3 years were in that low 30s and very close to the goal range.
Thank you, Mr. Thielander. Thank you for your testimony. Farm Bureau here. Thank you. Please be brief.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Doug Busselman, Minnesota Farm Bureau. We support this bill and think it's a good one. Thank you.
Thank you. I like that kind of testimony. Okay, the chair will renew his motion that House File 3022 be as amended, be recommended to pass and placed on the general register. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, motion prevails. The bill is passed.
Thank you.
On to the general register. Representative Albright. Can you be brief?
Mr. Chair, I can be really, really fast.
The chair will move House File 2072 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Transportation Policy and Finance.
Mr. Chair, I have an amendment, the A2 amendment.
The chair will move the A2 amendment?
Yes, sir.
The chair will move the A2 amendment to get the bill in the shape that the author would like. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Do you have an A1 as amendment also?
That A1 will not be offered at this time.
Excellent. Please proceed.
Mr. Chair and members, this is a very simple bill. It has the support of the State Bar Association. It affords for small estates to transfer the ownership of vehicles and watercraft to beneficiaries. In even more greater detail, you can read the briefing that is before you by House Research. I stand for questions.
Questions, members? Mr. Michaels? How do you feel about the bill?
Mr. Chair, members, we still need to figure out how it'll all work. We do have some questions, but we'll be happy to work with the Osmond and get it figured out.
Very good. Any additional comments, members? Okay, the chair renews his motion that House File 2072, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Transportation Policy and Finance. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, motion prevails. The bill is on its way.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Thank you for being brief. Very brief. Representative Hertaus.
He won't be brief.
He's got a good bill, though. Representative Hertaus moves that House File 3310 be recommended to pass. And where are we moving this on to? Committee on Environment Finance. Is that correct, Representative Hertaus?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I have a DE2 amendment.
DE2 amendment.
D1 or DE2?
Representative Hertaus moves the DE2 amendment to get the bill in the shape that he'd like. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 3310 establishes to create Sophia's Law, and it would require carbon monoxide detection systems on certain watercraft in Minnesota, and it also seeks to define the enclosed compartment as part of that watercraft, also the marine CO2 detection systems and the CO2
detection requirements. Members, imagine going out on the lake in Minnesota in the fall and trying to enjoy the fall color and being with friends and family. All of a sudden, maybe one of your family members decides to retire to an enclosed area of the boat. In this circumstance, a very young child complained a little bit of a headache and was in the cuddy down below to rest a little bit. And then the next thing you know, mom and dad find out that their child is something seriously wrong, and even mom and dad, both being doctors, can't save their daughter's life. This is a tragedy that could be helped alleviated by this law. Carbon monoxide, certainly an odorless, colorless type of contaminant that especially affects small people just because of their small body size. So with that, I have some testifiers who would like to talk about the bill. I've got Dr. Ben Beckler, Sophia's father, Hennepin County Deputy Sheriff Shane Meyer, Dr. Christopher Logue of the HCMC, and I think somebody from the DNR is here. So with that, please proceed.
Who'd like to go first? Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Thank you. Dr. Benjamin Beckler. Greetings and good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. The first thing I would like to mention or to say is to acknowledge my wife, who shared this morning with the Senate. She's gone through something no mother should have to go through. On October 11th, 2015, our lives changed forever. It was a beautiful 84-degree day in October. You probably remember it this year. Our 7-year-old daughter, Sophia, had a typical jam-packed weekend. She actually scored the winning goal on her traveling soccer team the day before. She had two birthday parties, went to a surprise birthday party for her aunt, and went to one of the United soccer games the night prior with myself, her mom, her brother, Will, who's 5, and friends Maddie and Max. It was actually almost a perfect weekend, and one that's probably not very much different from many other Minnesotan families with young children. It was busy. On Sunday, she had a birthday party at 3, and after that, we picked her up, and I convinced my wife, because of the beautiful weather, we could get out on the lake one more time. One last time for the season. I think lots of people had that idea that day. It was very, very busy. At the last minute, we decided that we'd bring our neighbors. They had twin boys, 5 years old, and their younger son, Josh, who's 3. I went out to the boat 1 hour ahead of everyone, as I often did. I got there, I checked the batteries, I took off the coverings, loaded the food, and ensured the motor started. The motor seemed a little louder that day, a little more exhaust in the beginning, but it dissipated. I did all those things that day. I also had the boat serviced every year at one of the best marinas in the spring and in the fall and winterized. My wife was often embarrassed at my safety protocols on the boat, and we would have people out. Enough vests for 3 times as many people. Throw buoys, reach poles, instruction before we left. I was strict on alcohol use on the boat. Tow ropes that were the appropriate length. Anything and everything, but certainly not everything. Sorry. My wife, children, and the neighbors came out to the boat about that hour after I got there. It was about 4 o'clock, and we pushed off around 4:15. The lake was packed. Everyone was enjoying the last few days of summer. Sophia and Will were showing the other kids their favorite places on the boat, the cubbies. There were 2 beds and a sink in the rear of the boat, about 4 steps down from the main deck, and a big table. There's a small kitchen and a bathroom in the front of the boat. Everyone got a guided tour from Sophia and Will. Sophia and I had actually picked out the boat together. It was an older boat, but sturdy and seaworthy. We had cleaned and scrubbed and brought it up to standard. We bought it from a reputable dealer. Was well known. Shortly after pushing offshore, the 4 younger boys started to argue, as boys often do. Just like always, Sophia was so caring, and she decided to build the boys a fort to play in the front of the boat. She held blanket by blanket from the back bedrooms to the front of the boat and made a fort for the boys, a total of 5 trips. The boys began to play in their new hideout in the front. About 30 minutes into our trip, Sophia came and sat on my wife's lap on the deck. She told Courtney that she had a headache, that everything seemed really, really loud. We had an old boat, and the motor was loud. And our exact words to her were, "It'll be okay, Soph. I'm sure you're just a little tired from the weekend. Why don't you have some water?" My wife rubbed her back. We turned down the radio, and I slowed down the boat so the motor wouldn't be so loud. I often would have the children right on my lap and help me steer to take their turn being captain. I went through each one of the children, and Sophia was last. She got off my lap and went to sit on my wife's lap. I had asked her to get off my lap, actually, because the lake was so busy, and I didn't feel it was safe for her to be on my lap any longer, but the busyness. She didn't feel good, so my wife suggested that she lay down for a little nap. Sophia decided to go and lay down in one of the lower bedrooms. At that moment, her younger brother, Will, started screaming that his stomach hurt. We all assumed the boys, who had been wrestling in their fort in the front of the boat, that he likely got a foot to his stomach. And that was the explanation. My wife rubbed Will's back as he cried from abdominal pain. And at that same time, I developed a headache. I started feeling off. My ears started to buzz. Something was wrong. The motor was louder. I slowed the engine down. I went to get up. I said, "I'm going to check the engine." And Courtney said, "Why don't you check on Sophie as well?" I went down the back steps to where you could access the motor and where the back cabin was. It had been about 7 minutes since she was on the deck of the boat. I found her on the floor of the cabin bedroom. I picked up my little girl's lifeless body in my arms. I knew right away what it was. There was no differential diagnosis. I knew it was carbon monoxide. I knew it right from the start. We started CPR immediately. Personally, being trained as a hospitalist and family physician, and my wife as a heart specialist, as a cardiologist, we tried. We got our neighbors to help. My wife and our neighbor did CPR on a firm table, and I struggled to dock the boat. I could barely drive. My mind was so foggy, I was about to pass out. The 4 boys, all under age 5, were about 1.5 feet from the table where we did CPR on Sophia. My wife called 911. She screamed for help. Why couldn't they figure out where we were? It seemed they had a hard time locating and figuring and understanding. Eventually, I docked the boat. I grabbed Sophie in my arms and put her on the firm dock. It seemed the whole community was there to help. Strong volunteers continued to do CPR while I held Sophia's hand, and Courtney held the other. The paramedics arrived. They struggled to get a pulse. It's called pulseless electrical alternans. There's no rhythm, so you just continue CPR. They called for a helicopter to try and bring her to HCMC, where they have the only hyperbaric chamber. But unfortunately, she needed to be stable enough to transfer her without active CPR in the helicopter, so they couldn't take it. The ambulance came, and the ambulance went with my wife and Sophia. They weren't sure where they were going at first. We were on the other side of the lake. I was taken by strangers in a car to North Memorial Hospital. I arrived there to find my daughter wasn't there. We first were told that they were going to go to North Memorial and then went to HCMC. Courtney, on the other hand, was with Sophia while they were coding her in the ambulance. She told the story this morning of looking at her pupils and asking, "Are they fixed?" The paramedics said yes, implying she had severe brain damage. My wife then shared, she wondered what it would be like to have lost her usual Sophia, but not thinking that she would ever truly die. She arrived with Sophia well over an hour ahead of me, and they continued to court her. I arrived by the kindness of strangers. I just have to say, and this wasn't prepared, to be left at a dock with no ride or no offer from any type of professional services, a police officer or anyone else, and to be taken by strangers was amazing. And to be at a hospital where then the only transport was a stranger was amazing again. And I'm very, very grateful. I arrived, and they coded her for another 30 minutes. It was excruciating to watch our little girl. It was even more excruciating to know what was happening, to have been the physician on the other side, to have looked in the eyes of patients who you've lost. This time it was your own daughter. Okay. Eventually the code was called, and Sophia was pronounced dead. She had passed. As if the death of Sophia was not enough, the doctors asked if there were others on the boat who could have been exposed. All four of the boys came to the hospital by ambulance. They were all found to have carbon monoxide. I was treated, and so was everyone else. Fortunately, their levels weren't as high as Sophia's. Everyone on this boat could have perished. It could have been worse than it already was. We were on the boat for less than an hour. Sophia was in the bedroom four steps from us for less than 7 minutes. The hardest thing of all is to think that this could have all been prevented. It is unbelievable to think that if this was a new model boat, a carbon monoxide detector would have accompanied the boat as a standard manufacturing component. But because it was older, it was never included and it was never mentioned. For a $20 carbon monoxide detector, my beautiful girl would be here instead. I wake up every day with a nightmare that is now my reality, that she is gone. It was discovered the boat malfunction was secondary to a hole chewed in the exhaust line below the bed where Sophia laid down. It was likely chewed by a muskrat. As her father, I take responsibility, and as the owner, the one who pursued us in getting a boat, but had there been a law requiring a carbon monoxide detector on that boat, or all boats, her life would have been saved without question. It would have been prevented. It's not at the forefront of your mind when there are so many other things, when the water's there, when the edges are there, other children on the boat. It's not the first thing on your mind. There are no second chances when it comes to carbon monoxide, and I implore you, I plead with you, to please not let this preventable tragedy ever occur again. And I thank you for your time.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Dr. Christopher Logue. I am the medical director for the Center for Hyperbaric Medicine at HCMC. I'm board certified in emergency medicine and fellowship trained and board certified in undersea and hyperbaric medicine. I'm honored to be here to testify for Sophia's Law, and I thank you for your valuable time. The Hyperbaric Center at HCMC is the only facility capable of treating carbon monoxide poison patients in the region, which includes the entire state of Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota, Northern Iowa, and Western Wisconsin. Carbon monoxide poisoning is the leading cause of accidental poisoning deaths, not only in the United States, but worldwide. Available epidemiological literature demonstrates that there is over 20,000 to 40,000 emergency department visits per year in the United States, and at least 1,200 hospitalizations, about 500 deaths per year in the United States. Since carbon monoxide poisoning is not a reportable disease and the symptoms are very nonspecific, it's probably underreported. At HCMC, we treat about 70 to 100 patients per year with severe carbon monoxide poisoning at our facility. About 5% of these are boating-related, and of those boating-related ones, most of them involve children. Just for background, real quickly, carbon monoxide is a poisonous gas that's formed as a byproduct during combustion of any carbon-based fuel source. It's a colorless, odorless, and tasteless gas. It can only be detected using a carbon monoxide detector, and that's why it's referred to as the silent killer. It binds tightly to heme proteins, specifically hemoglobin, which carries oxygen in your blood, and to cytochrome oxidase, which is part of your electron transport chain within your mitochondria. When you're exposed to carbon monoxide, your body can no longer deliver oxygen to the tissues, and your mitochondria can't produce energy to keep your cells alive. The organ systems most sensitive to carbon monoxide poisoning are your brain and your heart. Most of us are aware of the risks of carbon monoxide poisoning in our homes, and there are laws requiring placement of carbon monoxide detectors in our homes. Currently, there are no laws addressing this public health hazard in the boating community. In conclusion, carbon monoxide is an indiscriminate silent killer that causes damage to your heart and your brain. We must use our minds and our hearts to help prevent this from happening anytime in the future.
Thank you. Representative Hurtas?
With that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to renew.
Well, not yet. We've got some other folks.
Is there one other one?
Yep. Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Mr. Chair and committee members, good afternoon. As requested, I will keep my comments very brief. My name is Shane Myrie, and I'm a deputy with the Hennepin County Sheriff's Office. I am here on behalf of the Sheriff's Office to offer our support for House File 3301 as amended, a bill also known as Sophia's Law. Sophia's accidental death due to carbon monoxide poisoning at the age of 7 years old should serve as a testament and a stark reminder of the dangers this gas poses to Minnesota boaters. Passage of Sophia's Law will increase the safety of all our residents while they are boating on Minnesota's lakes and rivers. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, in the law enforcement community, we see that the underlying circumstances leading to emergency events are sometimes preventable, or at least steps can be taken to reduce the chances of similar incidents in the future. Once these prevention or mitigation measures are identified in the law enforcement community, we must communicate and advocate for both public awareness and, if necessary, procedural changes to prevent similar tragedies in the future. Generally speaking, Sophia's Law requires three things: the installation of a carbon monoxide detector, that carbon monoxide poison warning labels be affixed in designated areas of the boat, and the incorporation of information about the dangers of carbon monoxide poisoning into boater safety courses. These are prudent and necessary steps to ensure that we do all we can as law enforcement and state policymakers to prevent future carbon monoxide-related boating tragedies on Minnesota's lakes and rivers. Mr. Chair, this concludes my testimony here this afternoon. I'm happy to answer any questions the committee may have.
Thank you very much for your testimony. You have someone else?
One more.
Please state your name and who you represent.
Stan Linnell, Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. I'm the Boating Law Administrator.
Please proceed.
Thank you. The DNR strongly supports this bill. Education of boaters is critical to preventing tragedies such as this. I'll keep my testimony very brief since everyone has covered this very well. There have been other instances of fatalities in recent years and injuries as well. So every step that we can take to prevent tragedies like this is certainly a step in the right direction. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Any further discussion? Representative Uversal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I really appreciate this bill. I've asked to sign on to it, and I appreciate that you're taking a conservative approach to the requirement for boats at this point, but including that training piece. And I hope that that training might include a mention of the fact that very small children can be vulnerable even in an open boat, since they might be seated down low where the adults have all got their heads above the waterline. Thank you.
Very good. Additional comments? Representative Hurtas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And as I was previously starting out, I'd like to renew my motion to adopt House File 3310 as amended, that it would be referred on to Environment and Natural Resources and to the General Register thereafter.
Okay. Representative Hurtas moves that House File 3310 be recommended pass as amended and re-referred to the Committee on Environment Finance, Environment Policy and Finance. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. Bill is on its way to Environment Finance. Thank you very much. Thank you. Good job, testifiers. With that, members, we will be meeting tomorrow, and we will be putting together the lands bill. We hope to finish that up tomorrow in a timely manner, and we'll finish some of these other bills that we didn't get to today at another time. Meeting adjourned.